You know, I don't think it's a problem just like let it be known that we're recording this kind of well in advance of when it's going to air, because we're doing it after watching all of the House of Usher, right? So
yes. But it's also a general Poe appreciation episode, which...
And it'll go in January. It's just in the context of when we're recording, I'm getting to suspect that I've created a monster here. I think that Mike just wants us to turn into like a horror podcast now. Because yeah, we do a month of monster stuff, which, hey, even I was getting tired of it by the end. Then we roll right into November, and it's just all... end of the world and death and apocalypse stuff. I mean, like, and hey, now we're going to do some Poe stuff.
And then, you know what? Winter is very fitting for kind of like that bottom of the story. It's like the descent into the underworld too. So we'll have to do a bunch of dark stuff during winter or December too. So yeah, it's just constant. Life is pain, Jacob. Haven't you learned?
Yeah.
I think that's the, that's the big takeaway.
For our listeners anyway.
Welcome to the Voyage Podcast, a show that traverses the oceans of myth and legend through the lens of Catholic theology and philosophy. Come aboard as we set sail in pursuit of the heroic life and Christian virtue with your hosts, Mike Schramm and Jacob Platty.
So, yeah, I guess since you've pulled back the veil once again, this will be airing the week of January 19th, which marks Edgar Allan Poe's 225th birthday. And so this has actually been on our schedule for quite a while now. But we also noticed that back in October, I think it was like end of September, maybe it was the first week of October, Netflix released the Mike Flanagan Fall of the House of Usher.
Yeah,
which the mini series. So there's not going to be a season two of this. So it's all this self-contained, story.
Life's little blessings.
Okay, well, so there's tipping your hand a little bit too. But anyway, so this is a general Poe appreciation episode, but also a specific review of the Netflix limited series Fall of the House of Usher as well. Think we can fit both of those in an hour, Jacob?
I think so. I mean, I have a lot to say about Poe. I've been trying to get a little bit more involved with the outlines a little bit, or at least having a better balance of it. And so I added a bunch to
it. It's because you don't trust me. It's because you don't trust me. That's all right. You can say it. I'm
trying to bring a little bit of depth to the shenanigans, you know?
One of us might as well, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Welcome you guys to this episode of the Voyage Podcast. If that's not enough of an introduction, hopefully, when you see on the analytics where the numbers go down, we'll see at the 2.5 minute mark when that's when it'll be like, oh, that's enough for me.
Or, right.
Not quite 2 minutes mark. But so we're going to just kind of go through just sort of some general stuff. Why do we like Edgar Allan Poe? Not just you and me, but just in general, why has he had such a big impact in the last 200-ish years? And then specifically, what did we like about the Fall of the House of Usher series? And then what did we not like? And that'll kind of take us to the end. So why don't we go ahead and just do a little bit of background, Jacob, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. Well, actually, I kind of thought that we would start with, as is our wont. What's your relationship to Edgar Allan Poe and like pop culture, right? Okay. Obviously he's an author. Obviously he's a poet. He's written some of my favorite poetry. I really do like Edgar Allan Poe quite a bit. Which is kind of cliche for someone like me.
I was gonna say it's very on brand for you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what?
Well, I wear big trench coats and eyeliner.
You're very based
when I'm not doing this podcast. So I have a raven patch on my backpack. So
I assumed that was a Harry Potter reference, but
bought it at Hot Topic, so
you could have given me one guess of where and I would have guessed it right. So you didn't even need to tell me that.
I'm just making all that up. I don't wear eyeliner.
That's gotta be, now that we're video, we can't even joke about that being the case anymore.
I really do like Edgar Allan Poe a lot though. Did you know I actually had like half the Raven memorized? back in high school.
Not surprised. I feel like you may have mentioned that to me though too. You didn't use your House of Memory method, unfortunately.
I did not, and that's why I only got halfway through it. And I don't know. I probably don't. House of Memory
is what that was.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of something gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. "'Merely this and nothing more. "'Ah, distinctly, I remember it was in the bleak December. "'See, this is January.'"
I'm glad this is public domain, because we'd be getting in trouble then. So if you want to read...
It's a nice wintry poem.
That's for the Voyage Premium listeners. They can listen to the entire poem.
I'm going to do a full recital. You heard it here. Why can't I talk today? Wow, I am tongue-tied today. You heard it here first. Proper enunciation is key for reciting Edgar Allan Poe.
It won't be live when you do it, so that's okay. It won't be a live stream.
I will do a full recital of The Raven in all of my oratory glory just for listeners of this podcast and anyone else who shows up. Exactly.
So did you want to go through, like, did you have like a favorite or something, or like a favorite short story? What TV shows have you seen it in?
There was, all right, when it comes to like my favorite Poe, like TV shows or movies, I guess. I don't really know any TV shows per se.
Poe Finalia.
The very first Treehouse of Horror did a rendition of The Raven, or Bart Simpson's The Raven. That's the only TV thing that comes to mind. Actually,
The Simpsons also did a Telltale Heart. Remember when they destroyed that sign or
the diorama?
And then it's coming from the
floorboard. That's true. He shows
that one. Actually, that's the one that comes to my mind for Simpsons Poe.
Really,
reference.
There's just such a dearth of television material related to Poe, and then Mike Flanagan comes along and gets my hopes up. And then he delivers what he delivers us. And I say that as a true fan of Mike Flanagan's work. He's done a lot of really good stuff. But there's a bunch of movies from the 60s that were put out by American International. And they were like in the same era as like the Hammer horror films. And so you have The Fall of the House of Usher. Or if you guys want to watch some really good Fall of the House of Usher material, go to that movie. It might not be for everybody. It's kind of old-fashioned by today's standards. But they were basically America's answer to what like Hammer Horror Studios were doing over in Britain. But those are my favorite. Those are my favorite like Poe adaptations, is those old 60 movies. But there's some new ones too. Like they did The Raven.
Oh, John Cusack.
Yeah, John Cusack, that guy. He played Edgar Allan Poe. He was helping to like solve murders, kind of like based upon his stories. Did you ever see that one?
No, I haven't. But that does remind me of...
It's not a very good one anyways.
So there's a novel by Matthew Pearl where... So he actually does one on Dante.
Is that the Dante Club?
Dante Club, but he wrote one about Edgar Allan Poe with a similar kind of what you were describing in that movie. But I know he has one on Edgar Allan Poe as well. But there's also the... there was the Fox TV series, which was only two seasons, called The Following. And that
I remember that.
James Portnoy? What was his name? James Portnoy, I think.
It
has Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon's in it. The main guy.
But
The Following. My wife loved that show.
I thought season one was really good. Yeah. Season one was really well done. And then season two, I mean, because it got canceled after season two, but I think it's because it sort of fell off afterwards.
Uh-huh. No, that was actually clever. That was a clever show.
James Purefoy.
Okay.
But anyway, so that was another, like the whole first season was, you know, you had this literature professor who focused on Edgar Allan Poe, and then he had built up this following, and they kind of, one of the characters is like a specialist in cults. So there again, that's sort of part of it. But they're people, his followers are committing all these murders and stuff. And so Kevin Bacon has to like kind of solve the riddle or solve the mystery and catch the bad guy.
Well, I got to give a shout out to The Pale Blue Eye, which was also on Netflix. This is a movie that Netflix produced. It's fantastic. I was a little side-eye about it because the description of it is, a private detective has to go solve grisly murders at West Point, where a young student by the name of Edgar Allan Poe will assist him in sleuthing it out or something like that. And it's like, that sounds cheesy. Like, all right, you're going to use Edgar Allan, like a young teenage Edgar Allan Poe as like a little like crime detective, junior crime detective solving murders at West Point. I was like,
I'm sold.
They got your number. Yep. That's that young adult market.
Got me. Yeah.
YA fiction. No, it was actually way better than I ever thought it would be. Really good. Highly recommend it. I don't know the actor's name who played Edgar Allan Poe. He's fantastic in it. And the main
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Bale's the main character. He plays the private detective guy.
I think he's the guy who plays Dudley in Harry Potter.
Oh.
Yeah.
He's really good in The Pale Blue Eye. He's a great young Edgar Allan Poe. So definitely check it out if anyone hasn't seen that one yet.
That's on my watch list and I haven't gotten around to it, but maybe with your recommendation, I'll have to finally get to it.
All right.
That's not sarcastic. That's
completely. No, I believed you. Because here's the thing is I want to, you know, talk more about the actual man and his stories and all that. And then we can get into, I feel like the second half of this episode will be us politely discussing Mike Flanagan's Fall of the House of Usher. So, you know, I grew up reading this guy. I think that it really was kind of a, Edgar Allan Poe, he's like a spooky writer from back in the day. And so like back in like the sixth grade or something like that, fifth or sixth grade, I think I probably discovered him and was just like, I like this. This is cool. This is.
Yeah.
That was back when I really was wearing eye makeup.
Scary just stories kidding. To keep you up at night sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Scary stories to tell in the dark. Like I love that stuff.
That's like you're in, but there's, as we're going to kind of talk about, there's so much more to, I mean, Edgar Allan Poe than that. Like there's a reason why he still continues to resonate, not just because people like Halloween. Can read it outside of Halloween and it's still valuable.
One of the things about Poe is the tragedy is that like he was one of those guys that like wasn't appreciated in his own time. Like he had like a modest following, but he didn't like get the notoriety in his lifetime that he has today. So, and I don't quite know, one of these days I should read up on it some more. Like how did he, perhaps just like the following that he did have just continue to grow, I guess. Because now he's famous, right? He's up there with like Mark Twain or Herman Melville. Yeah,
in terms of American examples, I mean, he's got to be in like the Mount Rushmore of American literary authors or whatever.
Those early, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe, Herman Melville, you know, Mark Twain, right? Like an important voice in American fiction. And, he died poor. He died really mysteriously. If you want to know why he died so mysteriously, go watch that movie, The Raven. It'll give you a really good answer as to why he died mysteriously. They actually just found him like on a bench dead one morning. It's been a while since I looked into like his biography. I think the assumption is that it was like opium addiction or something like that. I think that he kind of, you know, had an addictive personality and got the best of him in the end. So
it's just kind of the slow suicide of that kind of pharmacological, I guess, you know.
Not to put too thematic of a, I actually do think that's why they use the pharmaceutical industry for Fall of the House of Usher.
It's kind of topical, but it's fitting. I thought it was clever. Part two of this show is going to be, what did we like about it? We have to do that first. We're going to do a compliment sandwich, Jacob.
That's right.
There were things that we enjoyed, even if it was somewhat tainted, you know, we'll get into that. But anyway, he's somebody who, you come in for the scares or for the kind of like sensationalist aspects of his stories, but they continue to stick with you. They continue to resonate because there's so much depth to them, right? There's so much more below the floorboards, so to speak, than what you can kind of, you know, see in front of you.
I think that he was just a very, very honest writer. Like that he had a lot of, he had a pr- pretty distinct theory of art, so to speak, about what he was writing. Mm. And he just really believed in the craft, in the act of like writing for the sake of writing and just telling a good story. I think that he's somebody who he would agree with, like Tolkien, for example, to like, you know, hit that bingo card. Where
check that off the list,
right? Yeah. He didn't have any time for like allegory or anything like that. He just thought that like storytelling should just be good storytelling. It's kind of funny because I've been reading through Stephen King's It, and there's a writer as a main character in that book, and he has a flashback to being in college, and they're in college, and the students are all like digging into all these stories, and you can tell this really feels like an autobiographical note for Stephen King.
I was gonna say, yeah, when a writer puts a writer in a story, it's like,
I know exactly. Okay. And so he's talking about this college experience, or remembering the characters remembering this college experience, where you have all these people who are like finding all of these themes in the books they're reading, and you know, all this postmodernism and all this kind of like breaking down of stuff. And his character's like, can't you just like tell a good story for the sake of telling a good story? And the professor, like, you know, gives him an F and like, you know, oh, you suck or whatever. And that's terrible. You
so
know.
Sophomoric. So
yeah. So juvenile and all that stuff, you know. And so that got really, because Stephen King is obviously one of the most popular writers of all time. And he's at his best when it's not kind of like moralizing
when,
or hackneyed.
When he's
it's,
not heavy handed. When he's not. I mean. We're all tempted to that, or we can all fall victim to that sometimes.
And this is also going to be a theme of when we talk about the House of Usher. And so that's fun.
Which actually, if nothing else, that betrays Poe more than anything.
It
else.
Does. Like,
that's,
no, it
that's
does.
Less offensive to us as Christians and more offensive to Poe as an
Poe.
Author.
Yeah, because you know, I think that Poe was at least moderately Christian. I think that he was. A person who lived in a Christian world, at least.
He had Christian Catholic sensibilities, actually, which we can kind of get into as well. But
I'm not saying that his fiction is. It's definitely not Dracula, right? It's definitely not like, you know, if you go and you read whatever Descent into the Maelstrom or something like that, The Fall of House of Usher or something. You know, it'll be tangentially Christian. It'll be of a Christian culture and things like that. But yeah, you know, it's mostly just storytelling for the sake of storytelling, but Poe really believed in this because he belonged to an era that was rapidly, modernizing in that kind of like sense that we talk about it, where, the magic was getting sucked out of the world and everything was turning into this type of hyper rationalism. And in response to that, you have the romantic movement that arises in the, you know, late 18th, early 19th century, and in which like they kind of just walk away from the whole conversation about like what is true from like a scientific materialist perspective, and really just kind of like focus on what is beautiful.
It's sort of a, so yeah, it's like an overcorrection to the utilitarianism that we both are, of course, very critical of. You can overcorrect it to this sort of like hyper-romantic movement that we sometimes see in, not just in literature, but also in like the visual arts and things like that too. And so in one sense, you understand it, right? You and I are just as critical of this utilitarianism, even though that's not necessarily the perfect response or the perfect answer. But, you know, when it swings the pendulum back and forth, you try to hopefully, you know, like Aristotle, hit that golden mean somewhere in the middle of this kind of virtuous like path. And this will get into what you kind of have and later on in our outline, you have truth is beauty, is good is truth, this convertibility of
the transcendentals. There's this reaction, because here's what, like, I know that this is like podcast suicide, but I actually do want to quote some things that Poe wrote, because I won't be able to do it justice paraphrasing it, and it's worth, and I won't quote too much of it.
You just said like the first like five stanzas of The Raven, so I think we're past that point.
Nevermore.
We've not only knocked at the chamber door, but we've busted right on through.
Yeah, right.
So
anyway,
as
something's tapping at the lettuce, let us see what then their ad is. Right. No, before I even start quoting that stuff, like, there's just some like things that need to be said is the romantics, they just like stopped caring about truth. Like that just wasn't, it just wasn't their bag, baby. And so they kind of looked their nose down at all this kind of like unmagical, unenchanted modernism that was taking over everything and kind of overcorrected, like you said. And I, you know, as Christians, we don't have that false dichotomy, right? Like beauty is truth, is goodness. They're just three facets of like our experience of God transcendentally through, you know, the world that we live in, as he reveals himself to us, like in creation, things like that. Poe, he actually wrote out his little treatise on like what he thought of literature, what he thought of, you know, his opinion about writing, things like that. So we don't really have to guess, you know, where Poe's head was at on this. This was an essay called The Poetic Principle, and it was published posthumously after his death. He died in 1849, and he was going around trying to raise funds because he wanted to start a literary magazine, and to like culture and develop, like the next generation of writers, because he wanted to like show the world that America could produce like great literature, things like that. He was a classicist. You know, if you listen to him write, his vocabulary is insane. You know, he's got an old fashioned way of talking, even by like early 19th century standards. You know, he's very flowery in his language and things like that. And he wanted to bring more of that to the table and kind of like stand up to like the European snobbery of his time about like this upstart American, you know, people without a culture kind of thing, you know. And he's like, oh, we can have a culture, we can create beauty and things like that. And he died as he was starting to get that enterprise underway. But he wrote some speeches that got turned into this essay. And this is how we know what Poe thought about. And so here's where I'll start quoting some stuff. In enforcing truth, and again, truth is what Poe of the early 19th century, he's saying truth, but he's using it in the basically what we'd understand as scientific rationality.
Like scientism, right?
Yeah, scientism. That's what he means by truth in this context. In enforcing a truth, we need severity rather than the efflorescence of language. We must be simple, precise, terse. We must be cool, calm, unimpassioned. In a word, we must be in that mood which, as nearly as possible, is the exact converse of the poetical. And when he says poetical, he's actually really talking about what we kind of refer to as like mythic on this podcast anyway, the kind of mythic or the mythopoeic or, you know, the enchanted, right? Like he's going to use this language of poetical, but he means that kind of mythic sensibility that we talk a lot about on this show.
Well, he's addressing the dichotomy, but he's not accepting it. He's saying like, that's the very problem, is the false dichotomy.
Well, and you can tell I'm not just spouting bull when I say, when he uses the word truth and he says, we must be simple, precise, terse, calm, unimpassioned. He's talking about scientific analysis, right? Like, so it's the exact converse of the poetical. He must be blind, indeed, he who does not perceive the radical and chasmal differences between the truthful and the poetical modes of inculcation. You know, journalism versus storytelling, basically. Like he says, there's a radical chasm between what we've talked about in times past. Like the Gospels are not a journalistic enterprise. They talk about real events. They talk about things that actually happens, but they're not written from a sense of you know, what Poe would call the quote unquote truthful. We think they're truthful, but like he's, you know, they're not scientific. They are poetical, as Poe would say it. They are mythic, as we would say it.
And yeah, to say, I mean, just to kind of, cause we kind of do our, Not Another Hero on His Journey, our episodes 2 and 3, where we kind of go through all this, and it's not even saying like it's historical versus poetic. It's yes, it's both. And it's that by calling it purely or just historical, you're actually limiting the power and the importance. And ultimately
it's at least historical. It's at least historical, but it's much more than that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, just to skip down, he says, I would define in brief poetry of words as the rhythmical creation of beauty. Its sole arbiter is taste. It has no concern whatsoever either with duty, which I think he's talking about like moralizing, like propagandizing, you know, putting stuff into things, like trying to like send a story with a message kind of stuff. It has no concern whatsoever with duty or with truth. And again, he's talking about like scientific veracity. We don't tell stories because, like, you know, if you want to find out facts, go like read a dictionary, you know, and if you want to get a lesson about how to live, go, you know, talk to your priest or something, you know, like that's just not where Poe's head's at when he mm-hmm. when it comes to storytelling for Poe. Right. I think that he overdoes it. I like the Chronicles of Narnia just as much as I like Lord of the Rings. Well, maybe not just as much.
But, no, I was going to say, not just
yeah,
as much.
Not just as much. But yeah, I like the Chronicles of Narnia.
They have their place. You know? And honestly, but there's a reason why those are like catered more towards younger audiences than the Lord of the Rings were. Mm-hmm. Not just because it's because developmentally that is what's going to resonate more with a elementary or upper elementary grade kid. Is going to be the more allegorical or directly allegorical. Whereas, you know, drawing out some of those beautiful, true things without the direct one-to-one, like this person is this, this thing is this, that's something that, you know, as you go up developmentally, you're just able to do better. It's not even a question of better or worse. It's just it's receiving something. It's teaching something in the mode of the receiver, which is a Thomistic principle when it comes to basically everything about theology, is that God is condescending to our level to communicate to us something, whether it's something true in the written word of God or the Bible or the oral tradition or in the communicating himself in the person of Jesus, is that it's a condescension of coming down to our level because that's the mode of us, the receiver.
And well, it's kind of like the explain something at five levels, like those videos. You've seen those before. So you got to speak to someone like a kindergartner, then you got to explain the same thing to someone who's like, whatever, a fourth grader, say the same thing to someone who's a teenager, say the same thing to someone who's an adult, and then say the same thing to someone who's like a PhD specialist in that field, you know, kind of thing, which I haven't really watched any of those, but it's a fascinating concept. You know, for us, it's like God has to do that with all truth for us, right? And ironically, we're still more at like, you know, the kindergarten or maybe the fourth grade level when it comes to this stuff. And we think that we're so smart and we understand so much about, you know, theology or God or something like that. But it's all condescension, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, really, even when it's just like the substance of whatever thing we're talking about, it's like we can only know the substance of a rock by looking at this rock and this rock and this rock and this rock. So it's like, it still is a condescension from this abstract idea of rockness to kind of get a little platonic to now we're kind of going into the Aristotelian of now you have to, in order to know the genus rock, you have to look at this rock and this rock and this rock and see what do they all share. And so that still is, yeah, like you said, a condescension. Even when it is, even if, like you said, you're a five-year-old or you're a professional geologist.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And, you know, I have a few more quotes. I think we'll read one more, then I'll save one for the end. But like, it's not that Poe is just completely ambivalent towards, you know, truth or veracity or anything like that. So he has another quote. It by no means follows, however, that the incitements of passion or the precepts of duty or even the lessons of truth may not be introduced into a poem, and with advantage, for they may serve incidentally in various ways the general purposes of the work. But the true artist will always contrive to tone them down in proper subjection to that beauty, which is the atmosphere and the real essence of the poem. And I want to point out the ironic reality that this is Edgar Allan Poe talking, because people do not associate Edgar Allan Poe with someone who is pursuing
darkness,
beauty,
pain. Nobody
he's the gothic, you know, he's the emo. Yeah. He's the emo kid of the, you know, 19th century.
The proto emo.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But you know, I don't think that Poe saw, I think that he did have like a morbid bent. I do. But I also think that he had it from a more classical position where it's like, as like a memento mori type thing. And I think that he thought that the uncanny or the weird, you know, were really, really positive things to write about, or that he was very interested in himself, because I think that brought to him a sense of reenchantment, like what we mm-hmm. talk a lot about. You know,
it shakes you out of that. It shakes you loose. It shakes loose mm-hmm. that mundane, you know, the mundanity, I guess, the mundane reality that we sometimes limit ourselves to. And so, yeah, when you're presented with the macabre or the weird or the just sometimes grotesque, it does shake you loose.
Yeah, you know, it's the light shines in the darkness, right? So if mm-hmm. Poe, he writes dark stories, it's so that the light can shine, right? Like it's there to, like you said, shake us up and open our hearts, basically. I honestly do think that's what Poe thought he was doing, why he was writing those stories. I don't think that it was, you know, just because he was just like super gruesome, dude. He was reactionary in that regards to like the kind of modern enlightenment principles of his time.
I don't think the website is like still going. Like you can find the old like archived examples of it, but if you Google search "Keep Catholicism Weird," it'll lead you to a website called weirdcatholic.com,
and yeah?
it tries to gather all of these like and I mean it's part of the tradition. Like some stuff is from recent, some stuff is from a long time ago, but it's going right along with what you said, which is, you know, some people are really leaning into, and I think for good reason, that. And I even say this to my students, like, you're not wrong to think Catholicism was weird. In fact, you should think it's weird, because it's supposed to kind of shake you loose from the everyday. It's supposed to say that, it's supposed to point you beyond the reality that you can just see in front of you.
So it's like the Keep Portland Weird t-shirts, but it's Keep Catholicism Weird. Right.
Yeah, so it's
I say that sympathetically. Honestly, that's, if anything, that's why I'm Eastern Orthodox, is like we're like Catholics, only weirder. So
yeah, you're like, you know, we already did, we kept it weird.
There's a very short, you know, he has a poem, because I have my works of Edgar Allan Poe, Dorset edition, right? He's got a really short poem called Catholic Hymn. It says, I'm gonna read it because it's really short, actually. At morn, at noon, at twilight dim, Maria, thou hast heard my hymn. In joy and woe, in good and ill, Mother of God, be with me still. When the hours flew brightly by, and not a cloud obscured the sky, my soul, lest it should truant be, thy grace did guide to thine and thee. Now when storms of fate o'ercast darkly my present and my past, let my future radiant shine with sweet hopes of thee and thine. See, there you go, guys. We're not making this stuff up.
No.
Edgar Allan Poe. So tell us about Catholic stuff. Yeah, you tell me something about
this. So the two things, so that's actually the, I was going to bring up that he has a Marian devotion, which as you illustrated in that hymn or that poem that he wrote. So that's always the thing that comes up. But also, so he spent a lot of time in upstate New York, or that's kind of where he lived. I mean, I know he's kind of in the Baltimore area as well, but he spent mm-hmm. a lot of time in New York. And, so he actually was on the campus of Fordham University in New York, which is run by the Society of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so he had a lot of kind of informal spiritual counsel, and was spent a lot of time on the grounds, a lot of time in the chapel or around that area. You know, who can say what he was praying or what his, you know, what was going on in his heart? But he never like formally converted to Catholicism. Maybe he was baptized as a child. I can't remember that part of his biography, which again, like you said, he had this general Christian upbringing, or he had this general Christian milieu that he was a part of. So yeah, maybe
none of his writing is like anti-Christ, right? No. I mean, it deals with madness, it deals with like some pretty gruesome stuff, right? But it's simpatico,
Yeah.
Sometimes I have to give disclaimers for some of the stuff we talk about on this show. It's like, hey, this is like not a Christian movie, right? But like, you know, you don't really need a disclaimer with Poe. Like, he's not going, I mean, hey, he might be a little bit like, you know.
So he kind of reminds me of, if you can remember all the way back in October when we were talking about Bram Stoker and Dracula, where he was one of those where he had that very strong Catholic sensibility for whatever reason, right? Whether it's mm-hmm. the characters he puts in Dracula. You know, we even talked about his life and how he was married to a devout Catholic. And so there's a little bit of speculation around that. So it's a similar sort of thing with Edgar Allan Poe, where he had a lot of these Catholic sensibilities. But it wasn't something where, like I said, you're not going to find his name on a parish registry or on a, you know, confirmation/chrismation list or anything like that. But it's more like the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter, where he had so much of this, where we can even see, even in his not explicitly religious writings, it has a lot of these things that would resonate with the Catholic sensibility, even if it's nothing more than just a recognition of the reality of evil, the recognition of, like you said, memento mori, which is, it's not a replacement for grace or, you know, but it's almost like it's an actual grace that can move you to supernatural grace. Hmm. That remembering your death can help you along that path to your need for God and your need for, you know, the sacraments and the church and all that stuff.
Sure.
So that's, I mean, like I said, I didn't want to oversell it. Like, that's kind of as far as it goes. It's not something where, you know, he has in some letter, oh, I just wish I could convert, but you know, it's nothing like, it's not like, you know, right. There's not going to be a slam dunk sort of, it's not a baptism by desire, so to speak. But anyway, that's sort of the extent of, and then like you said in one of his works too, I mean, Marian devotion goes a long way, even from the visible bonds of the church, like even outside, so to speak, you know, the visible parameters of the church.
Sure.
The love of Jesus's mother, like, you know, you and I aren't going to sneeze at that by any means.
No. No, it's more impressive than most Protestants would have done back in those days of, you know, the American century and things like that. So,
we move on? He was already an outsider, I guess. Yeah. he was like, that was just him doubling down on being an outsider. Yeah, he's like, right. You know what? I'm just going to love
Mary too. That
was
the cool emo thing to do. That was the cool emo thing to do back then.
I mean, yeah. It's like, historic Christianity is pretty metal, so no. Let's get into.
I was about to say, shall we actually get into the House of Usher episode series?
Please,
whatever.
Yeah, I've been dying to talk about it. I've been dying to. So let's say, what did we like about the series first? What did you like?
Listen, I can say aesthetically, it's really well shot, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of legit cinematography. I think that there's a lot of good acting. I think that it's a well-polished piece of art, right? Like, they did get a job executing on it. And the, you know, this is still the same, like, this is the round table cast of characters that Mike Flanagan has used in, like, all of his projects that I've watched. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he did Dr. Sleep, which is a really good movie, actually. I enjoyed Dr. Sleep, but it doesn't have all this. These Netflix shows, they always use the same people, more or less.
It's like, he's like the Adam Sandler of horror movies, where he uses the same.
That's right. Yeah.
His same cast. I'm sure that's a great comparison that people love. He's like Adam Sandler. This is the Happy Madison Edgar Allan Poe story. So I'm a sucker for attempts to kind of unify or synthesize all these different things. So, like, obviously Poe never shows up in it, but the idea that you're taking all of these disconnected short stories or disconnected symbols or images from all of Poe's works and you're integrating them all together into one big story. Like, I'm always going to give that at least some, like, you know, like, you're really, it's a monumental task to try to do something like that. And so whenever somebody's trying to unify or synthesize, I'm already sort of interested because I think that's just such a cool concept.
You know, I'm not going to lie. I thought that's what he was going to do when I heard about what the show is going to be, but I'm going to quibble with you on, well,
okay,
we'll wait. You sound like you had more positive things to say, Mike. Why don't we continue down that positive sandwich?
I mean, I only had three, but the other one was, I mean, I'm sure, you know, and everybody loves, you know, Mark Hamill's character. I think that was just
like
a fun
great.
Surprise.
Mark Hamill's
was like
character
a fun,
was great. Yeah.
It was a fun surprise. And he was just a very kind of, I don't know, enigmatic or magnetic character. It's like, he was like, I mean,
yeah, he's a
he's
fixer.
Mark Hamill for a reason. He's watchable, but yeah,
he's super watchable. He's like the wolf from Pulp Fiction. He's just the person that gets called in to like fix a problem, and he's this mysterious person who just, you never doubt that he's capable of achieving what he needs to achieve, blah blah blah. He does a good job in the role. It's a fun role within the context of this show.
I do think that there might be something kind of poignant in like his final scene. So he has, when he's if you remember, he like catches death. Or I guess we'll just call her death for
this
point.
We should say, we should give a brief synopsis of this show as such.
Yeah.
Here, why don't you go ahead. You give the brief synopsis.
So basically you have this, the head of the patriarch of the Usher family calls in this seem like you think, you don't know if he's an investigator, reporter or whatever, but he's going to like tell his story. So you already know that you've jumped ahead, like a bunch of stuff has already happened, but then every subsequent episode is sort of like him telling the story and it's sort of like flashbacks.
Oh, and a bunch of stuff being all of his children are dead. Well, this is not a spoiler. This is the very first episode. Like they're at the funeral his six dead children.
Well, it's only three at first.
But it's immediately, it's like all six of my children are dead and I'm going to tell confess.
And he says, I'm going to tell you how it's my fault or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he's going through it and not only do you get flashbacks to like the immediate present or like the immediate past of what's just happened in the last like seemingly week or so.
Yeah,
a couple of weeks. But you also get flashbacks to about 40, 50 years ago now. Is it the 70s?
It was the early 80s. It was the early 80s. Well, yeah, okay. Like late 70s because there's like the first like 5 years of their ascent, basically. So it starts in the late 70s and it gets into the
and all the way back to his and his sister's childhood too. But that's some bigger flashback.
Brief childhood moments. Yeah.
Yeah. So and it's giving you, so that's the rise of the House of Usher, but we're all seeing the fall but you also see the reasons why, right? The seeds that have been planted as to why this family is falling apart. And not just, you know, physically in the sense that people are dying, but spiritually in the sense that this unity is being broken, right? And maybe it was a facade. I mean, that's kind of, you know, what you find out. But he's going through episode by episode, and each one sort of focuses on a different kid, right? In terms of like that, it's almost like in the first frame, you're like, oh, it's that's like the kid that's going to die.
Each kid is a brick. Well, yeah, that's exactly how it is. It's and every episode ends with like a stamp, the fall of the House of Usher, right? And it's always immediately following the death of one of these children. And they're not kids, they're all adults. But like, except for maybe the first one, he's like a teenager, 18, maybe 19.
And Lenore, the granddaughter too.
And Lenore, yeah.
Who's probably like 17, but yeah, anyway. Mm-hmm.
So basically it's he's a pharmaceutical magnate, you know, CEO. It's a brother-sister duo. Roderick and Madeline Usher, those names are taken from the story, and they are kings of the world on top of this pharmaceutical company throne, and you know, ziggurat, if you will. It's about this mysterious woman, Verna, who is kind of haunting their relatives and them and slowly killing them off one by one. And that's the basic gist of this show. I mean, there's like no spoilers here, right? Like the show's been out for a couple months.
I was going to say by the time this airs, it'll have been out for a while. So,
if I thought that it was like very, very good, I'd be way more hesitant about spoiling it. But spoiler alert, I don't think this is very, very good. So I don't really care about spoiling it. Verna, her name, she's the Raven, right? Her name's a anagram for Raven, Verna. But she's Death. Yeah. And Death is stalking these people.
It's so funny that we had just recorded our Death episode.
I know. We just did a Death episode not that long ago.
A personification of, well, it'll have been aired all the way back in November. But
I know. Well, that's not that long ago, even by the time this airs.
We both watched this, like, probably within, the first month that it comes out. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, this would have been perfect for our Death. But
yeah, Death gets its own episode here. Yeah. Well, so we'll do a second. I don't know. We'll do a...
We're not going to do another one on this, that's for sure. So I'm not watching it again.
On this one. So,
she's Death following them, which we've talked to go back to our Death episode. But it's Death following them. And it's very mysterious because nobody knows who it is. Like, because she never shows up. And then, Roderick and Madeline don't even recognize it right away for various reasons, too. Again, like which you said, is very cinematically done, too.
It's ironic because I am reading it at the same time watching this. There's another similar storytelling element where, like, the kids in that book don't remember. They grow up, and as adults, they don't remember anything about their, like, traumatic past. And so there's almost this sense that, like, Roderick and Madeline Usher don't remember making a deal with Death, because it ultimately is revealed that's what they did. And so not only is she Death, but she almost has like a devil vibe going on. Like they made a deal with the devil, But Mike Flanagan is like an atheist. He's an interest from a Catholic perspective. He's an interesting story in of itself. He was raised Catholic. He was an altar boy. And then he had a crisis of faith. And now a lot of his stuff deals with being post-Christian, right? It's so like, if you watch his TV show Midnight Mass, he raises a lot of like questions about the role of religion in life, right? And really in his life and things like that. He really wrestles with it.
It's not in this like one. Sort of healing with it. This is him beyond like, I don't, that stuff's stupid now.
Well, that's the thing. You know, honestly, I wouldn't be so down on this if I didn't know how good some of his other stuff is. One of my favorite TV shows of all time is The Haunting of Hill House, which was his big break on Netflix. It is a fantastic series. I think it's like 10 episodes. It might be 12. I don't know. But talk about great storytelling, and talk about storytelling that it doesn't really have an agenda. It's just a really, really good story. So to give Edgar Allan Poe his due, I think that Edgar Allan Poe would love The Haunting of Hill House, right? Which is just about family and tragedy and, you know, how we're haunted by the past and things like that. Is very poesque, right? And I thought that Flanagan was going to
follows you around.
Yeah, well,
that's a zombie episode.
This was the person that was going to go and bring a bunch of, because that was the shtick, right? He's doing haunted house shows. So Hill House is a famous Shirley Jackson story, and then this follow up to that was The Haunting of Bly Manor, which was a take on The Turn of the Screw, which is another famous kind of haunted house story. And then it's like The Fall of the House of Usher, which is. It's not so much a ghost story, though it is kind of a ghost story, but it's more
that's what we'll kind of get into. That is one of the positives about this show, I will say. That it's kind of like you kind of said it was like The Babadook, where it's like you're not sure if it's quote-unquote real or if it's psychological or is it kind of a little bit of both, which I was asking myself that as I watched the Fall of the House of Usher 2, is that you get the sense that she's like a real quote-unquote physical presence.
Yeah,
but there's also this element of are the only people who see her the ushers, and so is there the psychological element too, which comes back to this very real like because even when they make that deal with the devil, deal with death, they walk out of the bar and they turn around and it's like a boarded up, you know, like nothing's been there for years. So
yeah, you know, I would say that like I never felt like there wasn't some kind of like apparition haunting these people. I think that what I was saying was that it feels like at times it's going for what the Babadook was trying to do, which is like, you know, bend the sense of what's real and what's a mental illness or whatever and conflate the two and things like that. And I think the show does try to go for that sometimes, but I think that it doesn't do as good of a job as like the Babadook does. You know, he has a history. Mike Flanagan has a history of doing really, really cool, good, exciting TV. You know, none of them has been as good as Hill House, in my opinion. I would say number two is probably Midnight Mass, right? Where, you know, even as an atheist, someone who's rejected religion and who had some angry years where he was angry at religion, you know, he admits this, right? In his mature years, his later years, he's started to kind of like, whatever, just think about it, you know, meditate upon it.
It's become Midnight Mass. Reflective. Yeah.
Yeah. Reflective. Midnight Mass is him just kind of meditating on religion and society and things like that. And so even though it's coming from an atheistic perspective, and ultimately I think we like just don't agree, it's still an interesting TV show. It's an effective story. It doesn't feel like it's, you know, it's talking about religion, but it honestly doesn't feel like it's like excoriating religion. It's talking about religion as like a genuinely human impulse. And so as such, even though I know it's written by someone who doesn't agree with me and doesn't, you know, support my belief in God, right? It's still, it's a respectful meditation. I can watch it and I can enjoy it. You know what I mean? So it's like number two behind Hill House. Bly Manor is just kind of
We don't get through the stuff we like about it, you're not going to have any chance to say what you don't like, Jacob.
Yeah, I know. Well,
So yeah. I did want to say the one thing I liked about you, you talked about how Mark Hamill's character is like the fixer. And what I thought was interesting is in the last episode, Death offers him that same deal of you can get away with this. You can do the very same thing that your employers did, that the ushers did. And he says no.
He says no.
And so he breaks the cycle. And what it makes it
super makes him such a more compelling character too.
Because
he's not just a bad guy. Yeah.
He also lets justice be done because then he gets arrested and actually goes through, like, in a sense, him allowing for justice is breaking that cycle of death. And so I was like, is he the hero? Like, is he the hero character?
Yeah, kind of.
In this story.
I do think
he's like, that's what is so cool about it. I mean, like,
he's a very interesting character. I think that he is ultimately nihilistic. I think that he is kind of the hero, kind of a hero anyway, because
in
like
this story, yeah.
What he says is, you know, I've lived my entire life without anyone having leverage over me, and I'm not going to start now. Because basically, you know, Death comes to him and she's like, hey, you know, the ushers are going to go down, but you don't have to. I can arrange for you to get away with all the bad stuff you've done, and you're not going to get in trouble for it, or you'll go to prison. And he's like, I've lived my whole life without having leverage held over me. I believe you. I appreciate the offer, but, you know, I'm just going to abide by the choices I've made and play the hand that I've got, kind of thing. And just walks away as a man with his own sense of, like, integrity.
He's Invictus at the end of it, right?
Yeah. That being said, that comes right after he's all like, you know, humanity is a virus. In other words, he's like this kind of like ultimate realist character. I think he's the type of character that a materialist atheist, he's the type of hero a materialist atheist writes. Yeah. Right. Like, it's like, I'm not going to give in to anything that
especially
I don't
some
believe
quote unquote
is true.
Supernatural force.
Yeah. I'll take the wallops I got coming to me because I lived my life my way, you know, to, you know, quote the Frank Sinatra song. And, you know, I'm not going to accept a hand me down, you know, or handout from some entity that, you know, I don't care enough to believe in, kind of thing.
So you're saying that Death was grace here and that he rejected grace. All right, that's fine.
Hey, I will say this much. I think that the show doesn't know what it's doing with Death. Because I do think there's moments where she's painted. All right, we're just going to go. This is going to meld roll into like what I dislike about this show. Sure. And part of it is like the actual script, like the actual story being told. I am not sure what I'm supposed to feel about these characters. And I don't think the show is being consistent with it. So here's here's an honest question for you, Mike. Is Death, Verna, the Raven, whatever, Carla Gugino's character, is she a good guy or is she a bad guy?
She is, Jacob.
She just is. And that would be a fine answer if you're watching like Hellraiser and this is like Pinhead or something like that, who is truly an amoral creation. Mm-hmm. But that's not how the show treats her. The show does not treat Verna as an amoral like character. She is too humanized for that to be the case. In other words, most of the time, you know, the rinse repeat of this show is that Verna, Death, comes to each of the kids as they're dying and like gleefully gives them their comeuppance, right? She's like a spirit of vengeance, basically. And she's super moralizing, right? Yeah. You know, there's a scene at the end when she's talking to Roderick Usher, the head CEO guy, main character, and like it starts to rain all the dead bodies that you know, she's like, your empire, you've killed millions and millions of dead bodies. Look out and see your empire, see your wealth, or whatever she says. And it's just like, it's already storming, but it just starts like raining bodies, right? And it's like a cityscape full of just like bodies filling up the buildings and things like that. Mm-hmm. And she's like, look at what you've done to kill all these people. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking to myself, you're Death.
Yeah, like,
you're Death, lady. Yeah, like, why... Why are you upset at, or why are you treating him like he's a bad guy?
He's done you a favor.
Yeah, like this is, what are you, what? It's so it's so disingenuous. Just, I mean, like,
no, I know that's it, because that's what it's like. It wants you to like put these really dramatic phrases in the character's mouth, but then you're like, wait, in that character, that's what you want him to say? Like,
yeah, well, no, and it's like every like when his son Frederick dies, he dies like the pendulum. So like, you know, he's getting sliced in half. So, and she's there and she's talking to him. He's like paralyzed and, you know, cause he takes some paralyzed medicine or whatever. She's like, you know, I could have killed you anyway. I could have killed you anyway. I wanted to, it could have been easy, but then you had to go and do some really nasty things to your wife. And so now we're going to do it this way kind of thing. And it's like, so you're going to give him a gruesome, cruel death, because he was gruesome and, you know, evil to his wife. So you are a spirit of justice. You are a spirit of like, oh, comeuppance or something like that. And it's like, no, you're not. No, you're not. Like, you don't.
Yeah, you do this because that's because you're death. You don't do it because
you're not. It's like the show wants us to sympathize with her as someone who's bringing justice to these people. But at the end of the day, and I think we all kind of see this coming, we all kind of know something like this is what's coming down the pike. She is the reason why everyone's dying to begin with, and not just because she's death, but because that is the pact, that is the deal with the devil that Madeline and Roderick made back in 1980 or whatever it is that there's a New Year's party. But so let me get this straight. She comes to Roderick and Madeline and she's like, hey, you guys are on the gravy train towards having all the wealth and power and ambition you ever wanted, you know, classic Satan stuff. And she's like, you know, I can make sure you get away with it. I can remove all obstacles in your path.
And one specific thing that brought them to that point too, because they had actually put themselves on that path.
Yeah,
because there's not only is there the whole like testifying, like possibly being a whistleblower, and then he throws the guy under the bus thing, but then also with their boss. So that's where the Fortunato thing too.
Yeah, Casca Montiato, whatever you pronounce it. Famous Edgar Allan Poe story where he bricks up someone, gets someone really drunk, and then bricks them up in the wine cellar. You know, pretty gruesome stuff. And, you know, it's fun, you know, to go back to positive notes. It is fun. It's kind of like a cheap Saw. It's kind of like a light Saw where, like, are they going to take these Edgar Allan Poe stories and turn them into, you know, gruesome deaths for these, like, despicable characters, you know? There's fun to be had in this show. That being said, I was a little let down by a lot of them. I mean, it's like, okay. So, like, one of them jumps on a bed full of glass and gets like sharded with glass a bunch, and it's like that actually sounds like better or worse depending on your perspective than it actually was in the TV show. It was really anticlimactic as far as I'm concerned. But
there's the acid rain one, there's the falling off the ledge, which I mean, they're also there not just for being gruesome, like you said, like a Saw movie, but they're supposed to sort of be fitting in terms of like just what brought them to that point.
Yeah.
You know, in a sense, there's a justice in that they're all supposed to be by their own hand. And that's what's so, I mean, not all of them, because then there's the one girl who gets like torn up by the chimpanzee, but that they're all sort of done kind of either seemingly accidental or by their own hand, is supposed to be kind of the fitting nature of evil, is that it consumes itself, that it kills itself. And that's sort of the big kind of metaphor for the House of Usher, is that it collapsed on itself, right? Which we kind of see the
that's
house
true.
Doing
listen,
at
I do
the
think
end.
I do think that is the basic moralizing of this show, right? And I'm not opposed to a good old fashioned story that talks about how evil eats itself, right? Like, I'm sympathetic to this, I really am. By the end of the show, they get really ham fisted. Yeah. With the, it's, you know,
the super political stuff. Is
yeah. Like, where it's like, you know, you guys are evil corporate, you know,
well, there's
blah, blah,
that.
Blah.
There's
a really
like
great
soliloquy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Madeline's final soliloquy is actually fantastic. Like, it's a fantastic. No, I like that. I think what it is it's Mike Flanagan being like, I just made an entire 8-hour show about how evil people are inherently, or rich people are inherently evil and corrupt. But I will give the devil its due and allow one person to like talk about how the only reason evil people have any power at all is because we give it to them willingly, that we are all complicit in buying iPhones, even though we know that they're made by like enslaved children in China. You know, like that, everything she says in that little final moments, I think are actually just truly accurate statements about the people, about anybody who participates in our modern global economy. We have all sold our souls for convenience, right? As people who live in the 21st century. And when Jesus says that it's harder for the rich to get into heaven than a camel is to go through the eye of the needle, we need to think about that. We need to hear what Madeline has to say, because we are the rich.
That we're
you
rich
are the rich, I am the
human
rich.
History. Yeah.
In terms of human history, in terms of how we live, in terms of what we ignore, in terms of what we choose to focus on and not focus on. Like, we are consumers. We are monsters. Myself, I'm talking about me. I'm talking about all of us.
I mean, we've all made a deal with death.
We've all made a deal with the devil. What Madeline says at the end of the show is 100% accurate. Her problem is she's not repentant about it. Her problem is she owns it like a standard, like a thing of pride.
I thought you were going to say like a boss, like a boss.
Like a boss, yo. You know,
I was
like,
going to use a different word, but then I'd get in trouble with our benevolent corporate overlords. So like a boss something, yeah.
So that's one thing I love. I love her final soliloquy. I just think it's too little too late for me. And most of the show, it's like, is just about how, the corporate people are evil, you know, kind of thing. I know that we're wrapping up. We got to wrap up. But here's what I want to go back to, because I didn't really finish it. They go into this bar. They make a deal. She's like, I will make sure you get away with killing your boss by breaking him up in the basement. I will make sure you get away with everything for the next 50 years of your lives in exchange for your children. In exchange for... let the next generation pay for it, right? Which again, this is a huge commentary,
metaphor, yeah.
Yeah, on, you know, let the future, whatever.
It's an global warming. It's an anti-boomer thing.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's all that stuff. But
it's a big middle finger to the boomers. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But in the immediate context of this show, it's fascinating because basically, and you see this scene play out at the final episode, right? So if you watch the entire show. And you've seen that all of these kids are basically were sold to her by their parents out the gates, but she's the one that made the offer, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's the one that's like, you can have all the power in the world, but I get to kill all of your children and the bloodline of Usher will end with you and your family. Are we cool with that? And the ushers are like, yeah, we're cool with that. You know, partly because they don't even believe it's real.
Yeah.
But like, you know, they're just like, whatever, lady, whatever. And so the rest of the show in which she's sitting there gleefully killing all these bad, you know, all these people like, aha, you got this coming to you. It's like, no, they have it coming to them because you set up the dominoes for this. Like, you did all of this.
It's a cooperation.
Lady.
No, but
yeah,
you see, the
it
thing is Jacob,
yeah.
is that everybody would have just lived forever if they hadn't, right? Death wouldn't have come for them anyway. They all the kids would have just lived forever if they hadn't.
Well,
made
and
that
I
deal.
Tell you.
Isn't that how it works?
You know, well, no, there's a good descendant, right? Lenore. Lenore is like the beautiful flower blooming out of the muck. Which one was Juno again?
Who that was the one who married Roderick. The last,
she's
sort of like the hooker.
No,
with the
she's
gold
not
trip.
Good though. No, not true. No. She literally went to the party, the Mask of the Red Death party. Remember in the very beginning episode, she's basically going to cheat on her husband with presumably her brother-in-law.
No, no,
who's
not that
like
one.
20 years
not,
younger.
Not that daughter. Not that wife.
The wife. The wife of
the
Roderick.
One with the leg. The one with the amputated leg.
Oh, Juno.
That's
yes,
Juno.
The
she's
the
one
addict.
Who signed to
yeah,
the
Legadone addict. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
She's the hooker with the heart of gold trope.
Okay. That's fine. You can have Juno. but no, but listen, she goes, and when it comes time for Lenore to die, suddenly This isn't like a vengeful death. This is a watery-eyed, sympathetic, like, you know, usually I like my job.
She comforts her. Yeah, she comforts her by telling her all the good things that will happen.
Your life had so much meaning because of what you're going to inspire in people. I just want you to know that, you know, this job isn't always easy for me. You made this job. You are killing this chick because 40 years ago you said, I get to kill this chick in exchange for you.
She's an elemental reality.
The movie doesn't present her like that. The movie or the show doesn't present her like that. It just wants to have its cake and eat its too. And it's I don't buy it.
Yeah, that's no. We agreed. So no, there was definitely some, like you said, some very sort of arbitrary choices that were made. Even though, despite, I mean, there were some cool things too that are worth appreciating, but. Anyway, that's our Edgar Allan Poe / Fall of the House of Usher.
Let me, I know this is super long, and so I want to read the final paragraph of Poe because it's important. It's an episode about Poe, and this is what Poe wanted to do with his work. Go check him out. We'll end with this quote. Is that cool?
Very good, yeah.
All right, here it is, folks. Like and subscribe and all that stuff, but listen to your Uncle Poe. It is no mere appreciation of the beauty before us, but a wild effort to reach the beauty above. Inspired by an ecstatic prescience of the glories beyond the grave, we struggle by multiform combinations among the things and thoughts of time to attain a portion of that loveliness whose very elements, perhaps, appertain to eternity alone.
Thanks for listening to Voyage Podcast. The Voyage Podcast is a production of Voyage Comics and Publishing, which seeks to create exceptional entertainment informed by Catholic values that inspire people to live a heroic life. Voyage Comics seeks to advance truth and beauty found in powerful stories. To learn more, visit voyagecomics.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram